I think I've been given the task of speaking next. So let me just, I just want to make 3 points following up on what Johanna said. By the way, she said that we've been hearing about talks about China's hard landing for about 3 years. I reckon it's closer to 10. So they just get bombarded with. So, and if someone ever claims that they're right 10 years after the fact, then I don't think that really counts. Anyway, I want to talk a little bit about financial deregulation, which is going on at the moment. A little bit about the growth cycle in China, which Johanna alluded to, and then finally just put the economic relationship between China and Australia in a bit of perspective. So firstly, on financial market deregulation, that's very much a central platform of the current five-year plan and very high on the agenda of the new regime. And so the question you have to ask is, will it proceed in a smooth fashion? Will it work? And basically, looking around the experience of every other country in the world, you'd have to say that the answer is likely to be no. No country is actually, including our own, has pulled off financial deregulation without some problems along the way. But that said, China has spent a lot of time looking at the experiences of every other country in the world. And so if they don't pull it off, it won't be for the same reasons that the other countries didn't pull it off. They have devoted an inordinate amount of time and resources into looking at what other countries, including our own, have done on the financial deregulation front, have tried to learn from it and try not to make the same mistakes. So you still might ask, well, if no one else has done it, why is China going to be able to pull off the impossible? And I think, and Johanna sort of alluded to this as well, China has already done a bunch of impossible things. Amongst other things, they're managing an economy of 1 billion people. That, I think, is close to impossible. Citigroup may be another example of something like that. Secondly, they brought an incredibly large number of people out of poverty in a way that hasn't been done before. And thirdly, they've dealt with an amazing urbanisation in a very short period of time, and Johanna showed a graph of that. So they've already done a few impossible things, and so I'm just going to butcher a line for one of my favourite authors, the late Douglas Adams, said, if you've done 6 impossible things, why not round it off with breakfast at the end of the universe? So China's not quite up to building the restaurant at the end of the universe, but, you know, they have done a few impossible things, and just because hasn't been done before, I don't think means that you necessarily can say they're not going to pull it off. But that said, I think it's a very much an open question. No one else has done it. They're trying to do it. They're going down the path of financial deregulation. That's fairly clear. There's probably going to be some hiccups along the way. The question is how large, and I think very much have an open mind about whether they're going to be able to pull it off. Then if you ask the question, okay, they don't get this right, the question is how big a deal is it for the real economy? So if it's the fact that the Chinese stock exchange falls a long way, that's so narrowly concentrated, it's not going to be a big deal for the real economy. So the question is, how do they not pull it off? So I think they are the two questions you have to ask. Are they going to get this right? And secondly, even if they don't get it right, how big a deal it is for the real economy? And I think they're very much open questions. I don't have any great insights into it. I don't think you can dismiss their ability to do it out of hand, but I think they're the two questions you have to ask. Secondly, So China will have an economic cycle. That's a given. And one thing I find remarkable is that, and it's been very adamant over the past year or so, people have this amazing fixation with variations of tenths of a percentage point in China's year-ended growth in the way that they don't with anything else. So let me give you an example. In the third quarter of last year, the first print of US GDP was 0.7, the second print was 0.9, and the third print was 1.0. Do any of you have any idea that that happened? No. Did the market pay any attention to that? No. Did the market have an absolute meltdown when China's growth fell from 7.7 to 7.5? Yes. A bit of context doesn't go astray, I don't think. But I think one of the main challenges of slower growth is very much on the nominal side rather than on the real side. So when you're growing at 15% nominal terms, that hides a multitude of sins on the financial side. So the best way to get rid of debt obligations is to inflate them away. That's been proven over many centuries. So China's now growing at a nominal growth rate of somewhere around 9% now rather than 15%. It takes a lot longer to get rid of debt problems when your growth is much slower in nominal terms. And I think that's what we're starting to see now, and we'll see more evidence of it. Doesn't mean it's going to be catastrophic. It's just going to be much harder to conceal because fast nominal growth conceals any multitude of sins. The question you then ask is, if they're going to have a cycle, is the support going to be forthcoming? And as Johanna mentioned, we're starting to see some evidence of that at the moment. The question is the extent of it, but they will respond if things get too out of hand. Again, may not be successful, but I think there will be some response forthcoming. Finally, just let me put the relationship between Australia and China in a little bit of perspective. I think the general perception out there is our dependence on China is about the same as Canada is of the US. You know? But we are not the 51st state of China. And I think the economic relationship between us and China is an order of magnitude different than it is between, say, Canada and the US. China is around about 30% of our exports, as Stephen said earlier, which are around about 25% of the economy. So that direct linkage is about 6%. It's sizable. They're our largest trading partner, certainly. They're not our only trading partner. I think that's one important thing to keep in perspective. If you think about what's going on in the resources sector at the moment, iron ore and coal, very much a China story. Natural gas, not a China story. All of the natural gas investment which is going on at the moment, that's all to be sold on contract to Korea and Japan. Nothing much to do with China as well. If China wants to buy some natural gas, all the better for that industry, but they're not doing it yet. I think you've got to take that, keep China's influence on the Australian economic cycle in a little bit of perspective. They are very much our largest trading partner. They are certainly not, by no means, our only trading partner. And finally, I'd just like to reinforce the point that Johanna mentioned. China's growth is slower. We expect it to keep on getting slower from here. But in the meantime, as she pointed out, China's getting bigger. So 7% growth now is about the same as 10% growth was 5 years ago in terms of its impact on the Australian economy. And so, you know, and as I said, we expect it to keep on getting slower from here as the Chinese economy matures. That is not catastrophic for Australia. There's still the impetus into demand in Australia is just as large as it was 5 years ago. So let me finish there and hand over to Paul.
Thank you very much for the speeches. It's Geraldine O'Carroll from China Construction Bank here in Sydney. You made no comment, Joanna, about shadow banking. I was wondering if you had any comments on that area and lending to private enterprise, which the state-owned enterprises are somewhat limited in doing. Thank you.
Maybe I'll just start off. Look, I think the significant growth of shadow banking is kind of a reflection. It's a manifestation of this regulatory arbitrage because China's policy, you know, their monetary policy is kind of a quantitative monetary policy target. They have an M2 growth target. They target credit. They have an interest rate cap. But as the economy grows and develops and the needs of the economy grow, people become very creative in finding ways around the regulation. And that, in a way, manifested itself to the extent that shadow banking now is like, you know, 60%, 55 to 60% of GDP. So the challenge here is, it's not like, you know, shadow banking sounds like a bad, dirty word, but it's not like all of shadow banking is bad. Sometimes it's a kind of a natural offshoot to kind of finance, some of it is really to finance real economic activity. The problem is because it's less well-regulated. There's always this risk that some of the activity is probably not as, you know, it's more speculative rather than real kind of adds real economic value in the economy. And I think now that it's grown a lot, I think Chinese government is realizing the risks involved in it, and they've come up with some regulations to kind of help kind of, you know, manage the risk. I don't think they necessarily want to squeeze shadow banking completely, but they certainly want to take out some of the froth. Certainly, the liquidity tightening we saw in middle of last year was partly designed because PBOC was worried that a lot of these speculative people were funding themselves short-term to do a lot of more speculative lending longer-term, and they wanted to kind of teach banks a little bit more lesson in managing liquidity. But this is why it's very important, really, to start developing the financial market going forward. And some of these controls that they have put into place, for example, the interest rate ceilings on deposits, they've already taken out the lending rate regulations a number of years ago, but if these deposit ceilings create a lot of distortions, and therefore, over time, I think, as the economy and financial markets develop, they need to sort of advance towards that interest rate liberalization. And probably they need to, at some point, move their monetary policy framework away from targeting monetary aggregates, which, as the country develops and financially innovates, targeting M2 or credit is no longer a really good metric to kind of figure out how that impacts output, because there's other things going on. So they really need to do that shift. So it's a challenge. And clearly, I think, but again, I would not say that all of shadow banking is bad, but we do need to understand the nature of the risks, and they need to start moving everything towards a more formal regulated financial sector, which is part of the reason why deregulation and the reforms are very important.
I was going to say, financial liberalisation is very much a response to the growth of that sector, but it itself is a response to the fact that the core banking system is very tightly regulated. And it's very similar to the experience we had here in the 70s. The shadow banking in Australia in the 70s, we didn't call it, that word didn't exist then because Paul McCulley hadn't come up with it by then. But, you know, that's what it was about, the same size relative to the core banking system in Australia in the 70s as the so-called shadow banking system in China is relative to the core banking system there now. That's what happens when you try and clamp down on the regulatory system, particularly on the ability to earn rates of return there, is it springs up somewhere else. That's what's happening. Chinese authorities are very much aware of that. That's why they're embarking on this program of market liberalisation, financial liberalisation, over the coming years. So, and as Johanna said, it's not that, you know, shadow banking has this very sinister association with that word, but as I said, this is just the financial sector providing necessary finance outside the core vehicles, because the core vehicles can't do, core part of the financial system can't do it. Some of it is probably bad. I'm not sure it's any more or less bad as a share of their overall lending than it is on the core banking system, to be honest, because they're pretty good at doing some stuff which is probably not that good either. So, you know, it's an issue. They're very cognizant of it. They're trying to address it. Again, doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a smooth process, but it's very much a similar situation to the situation a lot of advanced economies found themselves in the 70s, and the response is very similar.